fish dentist, asparagus tickler, minute painter. I don't know.
I've got poo on the brain. It's Sula's code brown that's got thrown me off there completely. So,
was going into acting a way of just putting yourself out there to cope with that? Just be like, well, I've got this enormous head, so I'm going to have to put it on televisions across the world.
I'm a little sour. That's just, you're going to get the sour version of me for this conversation. But it might be more interesting because sparks are going to fly. You know what I mean, Grant, the asshole?
Welcome to another episode of the Neutral Cider Hotel podcast. I am your host, Mr. Gabriel Cook. And coming up a little bit later on the show, we'll be chatting to the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Okay. Rain Wilson. Woo! Very excited to be chatting to Rain. And then we're going to be wrapping things up with a tasting of Hogan's Libertine Cider, one of the world's most award-winning ciders, no less. But first, well, following on from the Utilize debacle of last week.
That's another quid.
Yeah. Well, technically, it was for last episode only.
Oh, but okay, cool. So you're just going to hold that money from charity. That's fine. No, carry on.
Yes, moving on. So following on from that debacle, I decided to, I had a bit of a reflection and sort of thought about maybe the rest of my vocabulary too. I'm quite proud of my use of the English language. Normally my dad was an English teacher. I pride myself, but I investigated some of my vocal foibles and written as well. So I found the following, and my friend Anthony informed me that I say the word jewelry wrong. I call it jewelry, which that's just, I don't know. Does anyone else call it jewelry?
Jewelry.
I actually think I just compress it to like jewelry. Like, it's more like jury when I
jury.
Say
it. Yeah. Jewelry.
Hand us your jewelry. I'm sorry.
Well, I don't know. I've said it too many times now.
Yeah. Sorry.
I was just going to say, I think we know one for sure, and maybe it's on your list already, but the word geography.
What's wrong with geography?
That's his passion,
say,
Scott.
That is not what you say. You say geography.
Oh, yeah, I do say geography.
Everyone says geography
Who enunciates the EO in geography? Come on, it's
Americans.
Geography.
Geography.
Yeah. San Diegans. Anyway, we're going to be talking about geography later on. I recognize another one that I write, and I think I use the word idiosyncratic far more frequently than normal human beings do. So I recognize that, and that's fine. And then the third one I was reminded of is that if I say the word bonkers, then generally it will come up again within conversation within that same next period of time. So if I say the word bonkers again, you have license to pull me up on it.
How did you find out about that one?
Because I was in the company of some friends and
bonkers.
Well, yeah. And in the space of like an hour, I had said bonkers like 19 times or something that. I was on a bonkers tip. Who knew?
The other one you've had on the show, I actually had to point out to you. You said triumvirate about 14 times.
Oh, I did.
I was like, I hadn't heard of this word before. You mean three? Are you just saying
that's
three?
Right, yeah. I was a little bit obsessed with finding the most complicated syllable laden word for. Yeah, there's three of us or three of it.
I noticed you said spurious quite a lot.
Interesting.
I don't think I've really heard. I've definitely heard that word, but certainly not as many times as I heard you say it. And there was a point where I was like, I'm going to have to bring this up. But then I didn't want to make you self-conscious about it. And then you think you kind of stopped it. Maybe you heard yourself and checked yourself. But if anyone listening has got back catalogue to go through, check it out.
Yeah.
Start a counter. Yeah.
The list of idiosyncrasies is absolutely bonkers with Gabe. So honestly, props to you, bud.
Thank you very much. Martin, anything happening with you this week? I think there might be some big news coming.
Yeah, well, that sounds like it's good. It might be. I don't know. But,
well, I don't know. You tell me.
Not necessarily, just large.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Large. Sorry. Thank you.
It's more you're like when you take a dog to the vet for a serious surgery and it's like, oh boy, what a trip. We're doing a trip. No, I handed in my notice at the pub I worked at, The Good Measure, and I'm looking for part-time work because I've got a part-time job. But yeah, mainly, I don't know if anyone else feels like this in hospitality or any other sector, just super anxious about returning. Like, I thought it was fine. I was happy to do it. And I just had like a proper panic. And I was like, oh God, oh wow. You've got to look after yourself here more than you've got to kind of stick at the same job. So I've had to put myself ahead of my own interests, I guess. But trying to keep healthy and just keep myself in a space where I'm good. But looking for work now. So as long as there's no one around me, I can probably do that job. So if you've got anything, swing it my way.
Lumberjack. Lumberjacks are pretty.
Yeah, I was going to say, what are the jobs for people who just like their own company?
Fish dentist.
Fish dentist.
Asparagus tickler. minute painter. I don't know. I'm
just... Wow. Monkey tennis coach? I don't know. This is there's another individual, the monkey. I got that wrong.
You're doing it wrong. Sorry. I'm not going to hit a monkey. I'm not.
Don't hit the monkey. It's not their fault. You want to be by yourself? Come on.
This has gone so wrong. If you've got a job that you know insider, swing it my way. Swing it on the socials or swing it to Cider Shit on Instagram as well.
Bravo. This is the kind of chat you're going to have to put up with. Is what I say
to any
potential employers.
That's so good, Grant. Thank you.
Is that your interview laugh?
Yes. Oh, no.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. Grant, anything happening with you this week, my friend?
Well, I actually...
handed in his notice at Able.
Maybe the opposite of yourself, Martin. I actually went out for something to eat last night. It was outside, so it was they've got an outdoor space, so that felt definitely felt safer. I'm not sure about going in just yet, but yeah, that was lovely. We had I'm not going to talk too much about that meal. I'm going to move on to what happened this evening with Sula. At bath time, we had our first bath poo.
Oh,
yeah.
The brown submarine.
You've gone from like a lovely thing you've eaten to just straight away. I mean, I didn't expect that turn.
Well, that's what I'm all about. That's what I'm all about.
Yeah.
curveball.
How did you deal with it?
I wasn't doing bath time because I was prepping for this. So Jay was doing it. Got a phone call. And I was like, that's weird. Jay's calling me from upstairs. I picked it up. I was like, hello, you all right? She's like, code brown.
It's good to have the episode title straight away.
Yeah, there we go. Top of the show.
Went up. Luckily, I had a poo bag in my pocket. So there was a bit of fishing.
Was that in your pocket for
it's got a dog.
Or for you or the dog.
For the dog.
That's for right. You. That's yeah, right. I was gonna say,
just in case. Yeah, you never know.
You can
drink a lot of
short.
Perry.
Yes.
So that was an incident that
it's right up there with the first step. The first words out of the babe's mouth.
Definitely.
That's right. Yeah. It's a first.
Hopefully a last as well.
Yeah.
It'd be nice if it was the last. But I doubt it will be. So yeah. So that was an incident.
Well, I'm glad we've got toilet humor straight away at the top of the episode. This is like we've gone from depression in hospitality to poo. This is the whole thing for Cider. I'm glad we've got the full spectrum of emotions.
Sums up the industry.
It does. What a bonkers place it is, everybody. All right. That's going to be it for our opening segment. Let's jump to the news for a quick story, and then we'll be on to our big interview. And now, here at the Neutral Cider Hotel, it's time for this week's news. And something caught my eye, which is the launch of a new brand, in inverted commas, from Heineken, owner of world's largest cider maker, Bulmers. They've released a brand called Inches. Oh. And Inches was an old Devon cider company founded in 1916 by Sam Inch, hence the name. And they were like a good regional cider maker, making good traditional ciders, supplying in the local region to pubs, etc. And then they, like a lot of cider makers in the 70s and especially into the 80s and 90s, cider turned, well, it was tough and to sell interesting cider, and everything kind of got a bit cheap and it got a bit highly alcoholic. And so Inches developed White Lightning, which is a famed and still, you know, regaled and called upon white cider brand. For those of you in the US, especially, who don't know what white cider is, it's basically a cider of a high alcohol content available in a large pack format at a very cheap price. It is often the cheapest.
Is it also cider in air quotes? What's the apple content?
Oh, well, prior to there being a minimum juice content for cider in the UK, which was introduced in 2010, 35%. Prior to that, there was no minimum juice content. And from conversations I've had with various people who've been involved in the industry for a while, those white ciders could have been around the 10%. Possibly. You ferment to just super high degree of alcohol with lots of added sugar and then blend back down. Anyway, that's a slightly different story. because what happened is in the 90s, Bulmers, which was then family owned, big cider maker, world's biggest cider maker, bought Inches, basically for the White Lightning brand, and then promptly closed down the cider making facility in Winkley in mid Devon. But then also hung on to all the Inches trademarks. And now they have found the opportunity to utilize the name to present a new brand, and they're putting it very much. Oh, shh.
Thank you. Bonkers, man.
That is totally idiosyncratically bonkers. so they've launched this new brand, and they're presenting it as their sustainable cider, and they have cause to do so. They're putting all the cues about it being a sustainable product, with sourcing fruit from within 40 miles, which they do for their bittersweet apples they have under contract, and stating that all of the pomace, the waste apple product, gets converted into electricity, which it does. It goes off to local farms where there are anaerobic digesters, and it does get converted.
Don't say we don't treat you. Anaerobic digesters brought up on the Neutral Cider Hotel. Lovely.
Thank you very much. Give us a shout if you need your digestion analyzed. No, that sounds weird. Sorry.
Just move on.
I've got poo on the brain. It's Sula's code brown that's got thrown me off there completely.
So. Not me. It was Sula. Yeah. Blame the baby.
Sula's fault. Blame
the baby who isn't here to defend herself.
Absolutely right. There we go. Blame her. So what's interesting is that, of course, all the Bulmers products have the opportunity to make this claim, because all of their pomace goes into that use. So it's the very good and clever creation of brand and marketing narrative. And on the website, you know, they show a nice diagram of the flow of the apples and how it milled and pressed and ends up as fermented cider. They neglect to talk about the step of where they concentrate the apple juice and then utilize it. Oh, there we go again. And thank you. As and when they wish to recreate the product. So the the romance of the story and the brutal fact, not necessarily commensurate, but they do, quite interestingly, put the ingredients on the label. And this is an interesting step. And as it happens, the first ingredient on that cider is water, and the second is apple juice and concentrate. So we know that it's less than 50% juice, and that's, I'm just going to say, good on them for being upfront and honest and allowing the consumer to decide whether they give a toss about it. So there we go.
That's it. Well, I like the fact that all the fans of concentrated cider are going to be skipping back from that Rain interview like, oh, I've gone too far. Where do they talk about concentrated juice?
If we haven't done a deep dive into the good and the bad of concentrated juice, then we should definitely do that in a subsequent episode. I cover it in my upcoming book, Modern British Cider, and saying how, thank you, whether it is, something that is bad or evil, or does it have a role to play, or does a cider made from 100% fresh pressed juice automatically make it better or worse? Mm. There are lots of other factors to come into play. So maybe we'll do that near the publication date of Modern British Cider. There we go. Thank you.
It's just a book advert, isn't it?
Pretty much. Well, you're advertising, you know, for a job, me for a
book.
I'm
just using it like bloody Craigslist or whatever. Man seeking cider job. Jesus.
So there we go. Just a nice little nugget of news for this week. And so now we are on to our interview with the legend, Mr. Rainn Wilson. The Neutral Cider Hotel, it's time for this week's interview. Grant, who have you invited into the hotel?
Today, joining us in the hotel is a man who needs no introduction, but we're going to give him one anyway because everyone else gets one. It seems fair to do it. Finding fame with his portrayal of Dwight K. Schrute on the American version of The Office, our guest now has many titles alongside actor, including author, climate change activist, and founder of media and entertainment company Soul Pancake. He's recently turned his hand to the world of podcasting with a new show, Dark Air, with Terry Carnation, which explores the life of a supernatural talk radio show host caught up in a mystery of his own. Known to some previously as Ragnar the Radical, please welcome to the Neutral Cider Hotel, Mr. Yes. Rainn Wilson. Hey.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well. I'm well. We had some technical snafus to begin this conversation.
Snafu.
That isn't that Scottish? Snafus.
it is now, yeah.
I hope it's not put you in a negative mood, has it? Our snafu.
I've been a little sour because of it, because I've been dealing with it. I was dealing with it for 10 or 15 minutes before I got on with you guys. So, I'm a little sour. That's just, you're going to get the sour version of me for this conversation, but it might be more interesting because sparks are going to fly. You know what I mean? Grant, the asshole.
I'm ready for this. Oh my goodness. Right in there. I imagine though, you as someone who's a fairly spiritual person, you know, you did your Hey There Human series on Instagram. You've got many tools to cope with a situation like this, right? What are you going to do? What are you going to tell yourself? What are you going to talk yourself through this with positivity? How are we going to do it?
Nope.
No.
It's not happening.
Oh.
It's not happening. No.
So you've learned nothing.
I'm bitter and anxiety ridden, and none of my tools are working. So.
Well, you'll do just fine here at the Neutral Cider Hotel. Yes. Welcome. You're in very, very good company.
Oh, good, right? Good. You. Excellent. A bunch of bitter, jaded, anxiety-ridden, middle-aged gentlemen. Yes?
Middle-aged? Fuck off.
Oh.
I'm 30.
Well, okay. The screen's a little bit.
Listen, Martin with a Y.
Yes.
You might be 28, but you look 44, so.
Well, I feel 55. I'll tell you one of the reasons I feel a bit older as well. I've been listening to The Bassoon King all day. How did that come about being written? Because it starts off brutally self-deprecating. Did you need to borrow money from Oprah to talk about your head?
I spent a good 3 or 4 pages talking about how enormous my head was and what an ugly baby I was. I figured that would start the book off right, because then, you know, the book gets kind of strangely like profound and deep and personal and vulnerable. But if I started off with talking about what a ridiculous human being I am and what a ridiculous body I was born into, then that would maybe, the deprecation would like open people up to some deeper conversations. So that was my tactic. And it also happens to be true, Martin. I was a hideous baby. with an enormous head. And now I still have the enormous head, but I have an enormous body to go with it, at least.
So was going into acting a way of just putting yourself out there to cope with that? Just be like, well, I've got this enormous head, so I'm going to have to put it on televisions across the world.
I best learn this discipline.
Yeah.
Well, they say, and I don't know who says it, but it's on there. You can Google it, that actors have big heads. Like, and it's true. It's very rare that you see like a very well-known actor with a baseball head.
With a little pinhead.
Yeah, with a little pinhead.
This is true.
They've got big, big watermelons. I mean, if you're, you know, Bryan Cranston or Tom Cruise or whomever you are.
Has Tom Cruise got a big head? I didn't know that.
He's got a tiny body. He's got a big head. Yeah.
That's so interesting. That's why he's always running so fast, just to try and keep it balanced on top of his shoulders.
That's it. That's exactly it. That's exactly right.
Do they have to film like they did Lord of the Rings to kind of get the perspective right?
Yeah,
so he's got to stand behind anyone he's doing scenes with.
The visual effects budget in post-production to reduce the size of his head by 15% is... That's why he makes those big budget films.
It's all down to that. I actually happen to have quite a large head. So maybe going into acting rather than a career within being, you know, cider advocacy could be a way forward for me. What advice would you give for any budding actor such as myself in terms of, you know, a good way to be approaching that acting career, do you think?
You big-headed bastard.
I think you're ready to go, Gabe. I think you're yeah. You're very well groomed.
Thank you.
You're very well spoken.
Thank you very much.
Just give it a go. Just give it a go. I would cast you. In fact,
what role would you cast me as?
Yeah. I wouldn't cast you necessarily as like a child molester, because that's too grotesque and too harsh. And so, but what's child molester adjacent would be like, creepy uncle who lets his hands linger.
Well, I bet you didn't think that was... Maybe I will stick to the side of advocacy after all. You've given great insight.
I think you've made a wise choice.
Yeah. Well, you and I have something in common, is that you've written a book and I've written a book too. It's over here. It's called Ciderology by Gabe Cook. That's the ding whenever Ciderology gets mentioned. So there's normally about 50 dings a show. This podcast is effectively a very, very grotesque and blatant opportunity for all of us to showcase our wares. And it's probably not working as well as we would like it to.
Every time you say ciderology, it rings?
Yeah.
And if you say modern British cider... And if you were to say, which is my upcoming book, and then if you were to say the Italian translation of ciderology, which is Il Mondo del Sidro.
Can I get a bassoon king sound effect?
Ooh. Yeah.
Let's see what I got.
Are you actually?
That's more brass than woodwind, really, isn't it? But we'll take it.
Is it also the only podcast where you have a celebrity on and you go, I'm just going to talk about my own book? Let's bring it back. One thing that's interesting with Bassoon King is where you kind of put your perspective. Like, there's moments where you linger on an ear with mold growing out of it, but there's so much time dedicated to these weird nuances. Can you give some of our listeners a hint as to what it's like living in a mind where you look at someone's ear and go, how disgusting are you?
You know, it's interesting to write, in all seriousness, it's very interesting to write a memoir. And I started writing it when I was 50. So I was really only halfway through my life. But what it causes you to do is, I just started taking notes. And I just had a file. I had a Word file and a notes file. Just anytime I had a a memory or a funny story or anything. For like years, I started just compiling all of this. And I realized that it's kind of like, I've never read him, but he's supposed to be pretty good. There's this guy named Proust who's French. And this remembrance of things past, or however they translate it these days, that's what it was called when I was growing up. But it's all about how memory works and how, you know, how the conscious mind works and links with memory and what causes memory. And I found that very interesting things happened to me when I started writing this book, which was there were whole years of my life I couldn't remember anything really happening. But then there would be select moments where I could remember every little detail. Mm. And it's just so odd. Like, I don't know, from like 9 to 11, I don't know what the fuck was going on. I went to school, I guess. I don't. Did we go on vacation? Did I break an arm? Mm. I don't know. I have zero idea. But I do remember my competitive chess events that I participated in with astounding detail. And one of those being a young gentleman who I describe as being so far gone into nerddom that he had mold growing in his ear. And this is absolutely true story. I brought my friends over. I tapped them. I'm like, come here. And I brought them over and we kind of looked in this lad's ear. And I'm telling you, it wasn't something else. It wasn't like soap scum or something like that. It was, but think about this, like, how long does it take mold to grow half an inch? Like, it takes, what is that, 3 weeks?
That's a while, isn't it? It's a good while.
Right. So that's going to take weeks. But then to set up an environment in which said growth is possible is also going to take some time. It's not like, oh, I'll put a piece of salmon in my ear and then 3 weeks and it's going to be covered in a kind of a yellow, white, fuzzy mold. No, it has to be germ ridden, bacteria laden previous to said chunk of salmon being in my ear. And so we're talking about a gentleman who probably has not bathed in 6 weeks, or maybe he bathes just like the lower regions and has a thing about his ears or something like that. But it's the physics of it and the biology of it are astounding.
Well, why don't we ask him? He's here right now. Please welcome. Yes.
Chuck Stenowitz. He's a chess enthusiast from the early 80s in Seattle, Washington.
But moments like that, they stand out. It's quite a lot of body horror, which is what I was kind of, I didn't expect, with, especially with the front cover with you with a bassoon. But like, there's just so much grotesque shit in it. That's not a question. I just needed you to know that. I was like, oh, yes. Jesus.
So were you, but are you having a positive or negative reaction to that?
But both, I think. It's one where it's funny because it kind of does hone in on what's, like you're saying, it hones in on like those kind of things where the cogs are going and you're like, I don't remember. Why would you talk about being 11 and being in school when there's a guy at a chess tournament who is that rotten? Like, that's what's important. But
well, keep going with the book. It does get a little less body horror and a little more in the realm of kind of like spiritual and psychological inspiration and life stories.
Well, that should we discuss your latest project or your latest
sure.
character?
Yeah,
Terry Carnation. He's sort of grotesque in a way as well, right? Are you drawn to those sort of characters, those places?
Yeah, I would say I am. I have a pretty fucked up sense of humor.
Yeah.
And he was a character I created with a friend who, Terry Carnation, who hosts a late night AM paranormal call-in show. And it was really a fun pandemic creative enterprise, kind of like what you guys are doing with this podcast. Is like, I just got a bunch of friends together. We wrote the episodes. We got more friends together. We recorded them over Zoom and because a lot of them are improvised calls coming into this talk show. Then we've spent a long time editing them together, and it's been really fun. It's a scripted comedy podcast with improvisation, but it's got it's about some dark stuff. You know, it's his dead wife. In the first episode, his dead wife calls into his talk show. So that starts a whole kind of journey of, you know, is she actually dead? Maybe it was a mistake that she was considered dead. You know, what's going on? Is someone pulling his leg? Is someone taking the piss out of him? Governor?
Have you ever seen any Derek Acora?
No. What's that?
So he's a sort of supernaturalist presenter over here, goes on ghost, like, you know, the ghost hunt stuff that they
So
he's
most haunted
it's called. He was the UK, and I know you had a bunch of shows like that in the US as well, and he is just one of the most interesting, ridiculous characters that
what's his name. I've got to Google him.
Derek Acora. His spirit medium is a dog. So his spirit that he speaks to in the spirit world is a dog called Sam, and he asks Sam questions about people who he's trying to get in touch with, and then they take over his body. It's incredible. I think you would really enjoy it.
Sounds fantastic.
That is delicious. I can't wait. That is so
Rain,
good.
isn't your zonky called Derek?
My donkey is called my zonky is called Derek. Yeah.
What's a zonky?
Yeah. Wait. I just
you guys have really done your research. I know, your research.
Really haven't. Like,
professional.
We are the top four cider podcast of Southwest England. So
nearly Wales. Yeah, that's right.
Yes, my wife loves animals, and
do you love animals?
I love to eat them, and you know, I'll pet them or play with them if the situation is appropriate. But I'm okay with animals.
That just sounds suspicious, yeah. Though. Like, no one says that, when it's appropriate, though, obviously.
I know.
Like,
yeah.
I mean, no one underlines it.
I'm an inappropriate dog stroker.
Title of the episode. Lovely. Brilliant. You got it.
That is the title of the show, ladies and gentlemen.
Inappropriate dog stroker. Yes. Yes. If I find myself in a preschool with an iguana, you won't find me in the closet touching it inappropriately. You know, I like animals when it's the right time and the right place to enjoy their company.
So, oh my god. Well genuinely, we you compared our podcast to yours, so thanks. But also, you were talking about the pandemic. How have you felt dealing with essentially the big world thing in our life? This is the one big event, really. Like, Y2K was shit. This is the one.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. The first 6 months of the pandemic, probably because I'm an artist and I do writing and acting and producing and creating things, I was on fire with creativity. The first 6 months, everyone was kind of having a nervous breakdown and hitting a wall. And I was just like writing and producing and doing shows and getting people together and collaborating. And it was awesome. And then I really will say that I've been struggling like the last like 2 or 3 months. I'm a little bit going out of my gourd right now. And I feel very unmotivated to be creative. And I feel a lot of anxiety and I don't know where to put my energy. And I'm back in therapy and, you know, trying to deal with some of this and I'm raising a teenager, which is no fun under any circumstances, least of which a global pandemic makes it really not fun. Now, none of you are middle-aged men yet. You're all very, very young, extremely young, gentleman, probably just out of college. And so you wouldn't understand yet. But yeah, so it's been rough. You know, I'm not going to lie. It's been rough. But I've been working out, and I've been playing some tennis and lifting some weights. So that's good. My body's extraordinary.
What are you benching these days?
I did 10 reps at 150 pounds, which I know is very, very normal. That is extremely average. But for me, for a bloated, spaghetti-armed nerd from suburban Seattle, that's pretty darn good.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about your kind of physicality, because in a lot of your roles, there's a lot of it in that intimacy. So like, you've got Arthur and Ruth in a 6 feet under, Dwight and Angela, Crimson Bolt and Bolty. Do you seek out roles that have this kind of intimacy, or do casting agents look at you and go, Rainn Wilson knows how to fuck?
Yes. Unlikely sex symbol. Sure. I'll take that mantle. I remember reading an interview with, or watching an interview with Bob Odenkirk, and he was talking about how he really loved it when his characters that he plays get hurt and get put into really kind of difficult, uncomfortable, and painful physical situations. And he was always asking the writers to make sure that, you know, can I hit my head? Can I get stuck in a doorway? Can I drop things? Can I spill stuff on me? And I just really, and I think he's brilliant. I just love his work so much. And have from the get-go. And from when he made his start on the Ben Stiller show, which is really one of the best sketch comedy shows of all time. But I really related to that, because I really enjoy, like, can I take my shirt off? That will make people laugh. Can I, you know, be involved in an unlikely love affair? Can I vomit? You know, anything that's kind of grotesque and uncomfortable, I'm definitely drawn to. It's just my sensibility. So if I can highlight that in a character, I will always go in that direction. And frankly, in The Office, Greg Daniels, when at a loss for things to do, he would have Dwight take his shirt off. And I'm really not making that up. Like, we would literally have a scene, like, and we'd kind of be working on it and like, this isn't really working. And Greg would just be like, well, why don't we have Dwight laying down on the couch with his shirt off, you know, like he's taking a nap with his shirt off. And I'm like, yeah, let's do it. I'm like, okay, sign me up. Here we go. And it would just, it's good for a laugh, you know, it works.
Why doesn't he go into this closet with an iguana?
That's inappropriate.
Did you have a really good vision of Dwight, you know, when you first started? Did you know who he was straight away?
Yeah. You know, Mackenzie Crook, who invented Gareth, was so obviously with Ricky and Steven, created an indelible, unforgettable, amazing character that I had never seen before. Mm-hmm. And essentially, I took a lot of what he did. He gave himself a really bad, unflattering haircut. I remember reading an interview with him about that.
He got married.
He got married with that haircut. Yes. That's remember the wedding photos.
His wife was absolutely raging.
Apoplectic. Yeah.
Yeah. They probably came for the wedding though. So you got, you got to take it with that.
Yeah.
But you were saying about the physicality with you and that kind
of. And I love the head. I have the giant head, the aforementioned watermelon head. So how do I highlight that in a way that normally, if you've got a big head, you can disguise your hair in such a way where people don't notice it. But if you show off the entirety of your forehead, look at that thing. Look at that sucker. It's mammoth, you know,
it's beautiful.
That's an actor's head right there.
Yes. Yeah. That is, it's Cruise-esque, but the, but I love the way he would say the most absurd things without a hint of any knowledge that it was funny. And that when they all did that on The Office brilliantly. And, so there were so many things, but yeah, when I first read the character, I was like, oh, this is me. Like, no one knows this world like me. And, you know, and the great thing about Dwight in The American Office, and Gareth too, for that matter, is there's a combination of like nerd bully that's really interesting. Like sometimes like, oh, he's such a dork. And sometimes it's like, oh, he's such an egregious bully and so inappropriately, you know, hostile, aggressive, like overbearing. But you can't really put your finger on who he is as a character. Like, is he, you know, is he white trash? Is he a farmer? Is he, you know, is he a salesman? Is he a dork? You know, is he a suck up? And it's like, he's kind of all of these things. And that was, I think, for Greg Daniels and for Ricky, you know, and the characters they created for both offices, like you never could put your finger on, who the characters were. You know, they were three-dimensional. They were interesting. They had a lot of facets. And I think that's why Dwight has lasted, as a character, as a well-known, beloved character. Dare I say that? Can one say that about one's own work? But he is, he's a beloved character. I don't know if he is in the UK, but in the United States he is. And I think it's cause it's just like, you can't quite episode to episode. You can't quite put your finger on who he is.
So when the office is ending and you've been playing this character for, you know, 10 years, how did that feel? How did you feel about the next step? Were you worried about being typecast? Were you nervous about losing a part of your identity with Dwight? Or, you know, I'm interested to know how that felt with that coming to an end, or whether you're just like, cool, it's brilliant, we've done it, move on.
Yeah. Well, it's been, you know, this is a real challenge. So Dwight is an iconic character that is well loved by a lot of people. And I'll always be known as Dwight, kind of first and foremost, no matter what I do. Even if I'm on another hit TV show that goes for 10 years, I mean, it's never going to surpass the way The Office was kind of one of the very last shows in America. I don't know what happened in the UK, but The Office, Modern Family, Big Bang Theory all kind of started around the same time. And those were the last kind of big comedies that had a big, broad audience. And after that, all the comedies are very niche, you know, you have other, baskets, or you have, Ted Lasso or whatever, these other comedies, but they're, you know, they might only have like a couple hundred thousand people watching each episode. Search Party is one I like. Incredible doors were opened because I got to play Dwight. It, you know, allowed me a certain measure of, you know, celebrity and opened my way for, you know, jobs and trips and money-making opportunities and stuff like that. So I bought a house, you know, I mean, that's really all you want as an actor is like, can you buy a, at the end of the day, can you,
bricks and mortar,
can you buy a fucking house, you know, and,
stroke an iguana, buy a house.
Stroking, that's an excellent euphemism. But but at the same time, it's tough because, you know, I'm known as this one role. And a lot of times I've talked to my agents, I get turned down for things like, they just think he's too recognizable. Like, it'll throw people off to have the guy who played Dwight there, you know. It's that weird line of like, you know, if Robert Downey Jr.'s in a movie, do people look at him and go, oh, that's Iron Man? Like, so what is it about, you know, what?
Wait a minute, that guy's Iron Man.
whoa, stop the movie. Oh.
It's all smoke and mirrors.
Stop the projector, please.
The train's coming right at us.
But So it's an interesting challenge. But here's the deal, Grant. I went to theater school in New York. You Brits, I don't know about the Scots, but you Brits understand like the world of the theater and what the role of the actor is. Like, I play characters. So sometimes I'm in dramas, sometimes I'm in comedies. I transform, I'll play a bad guy, I'll play a nerdy guy, I'll play a dumb guy. And that's it. I was playing dozens of roles before I did The Office, and I'll play dozens of roles after The Office, and people will either give a fuck about them or they won't give a fuck about them, and that's okay. Hopefully at the end of the day, they'll kind of go, oh wow, this guy played a lot of different roles besides Dwight, look at that. But maybe they won't. It's okay. I have a good time. And I just make sure to keep things really on the up and up with my iguana, and just treat him with the respect that he deserves, and not do anything in private with him, and not so my wife doesn't walk in with me and my iguana.
Sorry, she's looking after the zonkey. It's fine anyway. Sure. Derek's, looking after himself. Yeah. It's all good.
Yeah.
Rain, I was going to ask you around the nature of fame and the level of desire of it from your part, or whether it's simply a necessity in order for you to create, in order to achieve all of the creative aspirations that you have in terms of acting. Being a successful actor, being good at your craft and your skill, naturally sort of comes with a degree of fame. Is that something that you have liked, enjoyed, or is it just something that just comes with the territory?
Yeah, that could be a whole podcast subject. And I don't think people talk about fame enough, and they don't really dive into it. You know, they were interviewing young American kids. It was about 10 years ago. And they said, what do you want, more than anything? And it wasn't money, and it wasn't love, and it wasn't wealth, and it wasn't a great career. They wanted fame. Fame was the number one thing that young Americans wanted. And because when you have fame, you get money, and you get attention, and you get love, and you get status, and you get good jobs. So, but now you have, because of social media and podcasts and, siderology.
Don't give it credence, please.
Not everyone, but there are just tens of thousands of people seeking it who don't have any appreciable skills at getting it. They're not necessarily a comedian or a great musician or a great artist or what have you. So, I never honestly, it all from the bottom of my heart, with all truthfulness, I did not seek fame. I simply wanted to work. I worked for years in theater. Then I wanted to work in film and TV so I could make a little money and pay off my student loans and eventually buy a house. But I did not even really think about fame. And then all of a sudden, with 6 Feet Under, and then swiftly thereafter, The Office, all of a sudden I was famous. I mean, I remember, my God. So the Office is set in the city of Scranton in Pennsylvania. And 6 months after the show aired, they invited me to go inaugurate their new mall. So they flew me to Scranton and paid me, at the time, what was a boatload of money for me, to be at this mall, and people could line up and I would sign autographs. And they're like, Rainn Wilson from The Office is coming to Scranton. And they picked me up in the airport in a police escort, four cop cars and a stretch limo. And they brought me to the mayor's office, and they gave me the key to the city. And I met with the town council, and this guy was proposing to his girlfriend. And I kind of initiated it, or inaugurated him doing,
presided over the whole thing.
I presided. Excellent choice of words. And Gabe, do you use words like that in siderology?
Oh, all the time. I do.
We actually talked about, I have a ridiculous use of the English language. I utilize the word utilize far too much, so much so that I was called out on social media, and every time I say the word, I now have to give money to charities. So there's a few extra quid gone. I say the word idiosyncratic far too often, and I can't say the word jewelry properly. I say jewelry, apparently. So it's a minefield. It's a minefield.
This is the weirdest brag session. Like, you're talking to a man. This man has actually, I think you may be one of the only people to beat a presidential candidate in a rap battle on TV. Like, your level of fame is weird, insane, and idiosyncratic. But talking about fame, we've got probably Scotland's sixth best percussionist here.
Sure.
We obviously know you through Grant. How did you come to find Frightened Rabbit as a band?
Well, that's a great question too. I don't remember who turned me on to Frightened Rabbit, but, when I heard Heads Rolled Off when that first came out, and then me and my friends and everyone I knew and everyone on the office were huge Frightened Rabbit fans. And we were just like, our minds were blown. I got in touch with Scott and Grant and other members of the band, and I had them on this talk show I did in the back of a van, and I went to a whole bunch of shows and brought them to the office set when they were in LA. And I think I saw Frightened Rabbit maybe four times live, and we were just huge fans. And loved Grant's thundering drums. Do you remember the band Big Country from Scotland?
Yeah.
In a big country, dreams real vivid. You guys, I think Scottish percussionists are playing like they're playing the drums of the Moors.
They're as if their lives depended on it.
I remember one show I particularly remember that you attended, you and John. It was at the Knitting Factory in LA, and you'd been at like the Emmys or the Golden Globes or something. I remember it was just, I think we'd visited the set the day before, and we were like, oh yeah, we've got a show this night, and you're like, oh no. And this is like the only time it's ever happened that someone goes, oh, I've got to go to the Emmys. Like, oh
yeah.
But then you're like, oh,
that's a good excuse.
But you were both like, what time are you on? We'll come down after. We're like, there's no fucking way they're gonna come down. You know, we put these names, your names on the guest list, and people at the door probably think we're taking the piss, you know. And then yeah, you both turned up in your tuxedos at the Knitting Factory. See,
yeah, like 10:30 at night.
Yeah.
Great show.
It was incredible. It was great. And I guess maybe going back to fame a little bit, how, you know, you didn't exactly attempt to blend in at that event, did you? Like, you arrive with like one of LA's tallest actors, wearing tuxedos. I don't know if you had awards.
Rain's giant head. What chances did he have to blend
in? Krasinski's got a big noggin too, by the way.
Yeah, is this lengthy? I feel like his would be quite lengthy.
Yeah, it's lengthy. Yeah, it's a bit engorged. Yeah.
You went, let's bring it back to fame, and now we're talking about John Krasinski's head length.
No, I think it's even bigger than that, Grant. I think we were brought there by limousine, and the limousine waited for us to finish the show and brought us back home.
Sounds about right.
And the Knitting Factory. At that point in time, that was a little piss hole. I mean, that was a crappy little venue. You've since played a lot bigger, better venues than that. I don't know why you were playing that in LA when it was, but the sound was great and we were up above the stage. I remember it distinctly. It was amazing.
Wow. Thank you very much. I'm visiting the set of the office at that time was probably the best thing that had happened in my life. And I still remember the scene that you were shooting as we arrived, and then afterwards we're in this little room and Steve Carell comes in and actually introduces himself, which I just thought was so incredible. And you know, you obviously know him particularly well, but just to to be so humble to do that, to come and be, hi, I'm Steve. You know, we're all like, yeah, we fucking know.
Scottish accent there.
I think it was Josh Ritter. Was it not Josh Ritter that put you onto us? I feel like that was what you said.
I don't know if it was. No. You know what? I put Josh onto you guys.
Oh, did you?
You're the tastemaker.
I turned Josh Ritter onto you guys, and then he brought Scott on one of his little tours as a solo act. Yeah. Yeah.
And you were in New York, right?
That's right. But I love that you were one of the great rock bands of the last 20 years, and the greatest moment of your life was visiting the set of The Office. I don't know if that's really cool or really pathetic.
I think it's pretty cool. Martin, would you agree?
No strong opinions on The Office.
Talk about The Office quickly again. What was your favorite prank that Jim played on you?
You asking me or Martin?
Yes. No, I'm asking.
Yeah, Rain, if you wait there, I'll do a long speech.
I don't know. I really loved the one where Dwight's desk gets moved into the bathroom. And I loved it because at the very end, he's like, he tracks the cords, the phone cords, and he finds it goes into the bathroom, and he goes in the bathroom, and he's like, oh, he's like, damn it, Jim. And he finds the desk, and then the phone rings and he looks at it, and then he answers it. Dunder Mifflin, this is Dwight. And then there's a flush. And then Kevin, the large accountant, comes out of the stall. And it was just like that moment was just a really beautiful, underplayed, delicious comic moment that, of course, he's going to answer the phone because that's the kind of clown that he is. And then, of course, the toilet. And it probably, you can just immediately imagine the smell of the bathroom at the time. So that was a fun one.
I think for me, the two best ones are, it's the meatball reversal one. You just got meatballed, where you trick the prank backwards, but also the one where you come in dressed as Jim and you're acting as Dwight, acting as Jim. Uh-huh. And the end of it, it's the beautiful moment where you go,
Will you comment?
Yes. Yeah. So good. It's fucking amazing.
Sidewinder comment. That was fun.
Did the office just feel like fun? Did it just feel like you were just going into like an office with your friends?
It really was. We would have guest directors come on the show, and their jaws would literally drop, not figuratively, literally drop. And because they were like, everyone loves each other. Like, we're 9 seasons in and we're all hugging and high fiving and laughing and joking around and goofing off. And it just was a really warm, inviting, fun, collaborative atmosphere. And that really started with Greg Daniels at the top and Steve Carell at the top. And but there were days, sometimes you get in at 5:30 in the morning and you're grumpy and you're thinking about, your marriage and your life and your bunions, and you don't feel like being there. And there were hard days, but by and large, it was a super fun, incredible creative experience. I don't think I'll ever have, I've been on 2 TV shows since then. And it's never even come close.
Is there something about the nature of the fact that it originated as a British comedy? Are you a fan of sort of British comedy? And, you know, you talk about the self-deprecating nature and some of the subtlety that's involved of things. And maybe because of, you had a theatrical background rather than somebody coming straight out of acting school, sort of straight into the big show, that learning that craft and some of that uniqueness, which is, more commonly associated with British kind of comedy. Is that something that really kind of you get into, that you really enjoy?
Well, I'm a huge fan of British comedy. I mean, Monty Python kind of made me who I am. They used to show it oddly enough, on American public television, which for those who know, it's a really lame. It just shows like animal documentaries and really boring news documentaries. And then at like midnight on the weekends, it would show Monty Python. And I would record episodes on my cassette deck recorder, my Panasonic cassette deck recorder. I would hold it up to the TV and I would memorize them, you know. And it was, but, you know, going forward, like, I'm a huge Steve Coogan, Alan Partridge fan. He's, I absolutely adore
Brilliant.
Him. And I love the Mighty Boosh. Absolutely love them. And Noel Fielding. And yeah, there's so much great British comedy. And
have you watched League of Gentlemen before?
I've not seen League of Gentlemen.
You will,
oh, mate, you will fucking love
worth
it.
Worth a go. And Inside Number 9, who which also came subsequently from two of the same writers.
A few series.
Oh, great.
Dark and funny.
Yeah.
Dark and funny.
Just give your homework to do.
Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. I love that one.
Oh, Garth Marenghi.
Oh, that's... When I heard Terry Carnation, I was like, he must have watched Garth Marenghi's Dark Place because it's got that same thing. Oh, it's fucking,
definitely
it's that same tone.
Totally different world, but it's in that genre. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, love that one.
Well, you directed some of the episodes of The Office as well. Is that something that you'd like to do more of, or is there anything that you've got in the pipeline?
Yeah, there's a movie that I wrote that we have producers attached to and some funding, and we're just trying to cast it, which is very tricky and difficult in terms of making box office back. So, there's a couple other screenplay projects I'm trying to write in order to direct. I don't really want to direct television so much I don't know how it is in the UK, but in the United States, it's not a terribly interesting job to direct someone else's TV show because you're just handed the script. You know, you can give a couple notes, but they don't really want you to like mix it up and meddle in it. The actors know what they're doing. They know how they're going to do it. The look and feel of the show has already been created. You're just there to kind of like move the cameras around and tell the story according to the kind of the vision and the Bible of that particular television show. So, and then it takes a long time. So, you know, it's 2 weeks of prep and, you know, a week and a half of shooting and then a couple weeks of post. So it takes a big chunkier time up. So I'm not really that interested in that, but trying to get some film stuff off the ground. One of the great things I did is I did an appearance on this new Star Trek show as the legendary Harry Mudd, this character back from the original series in the late 60s. And, they were doing these Star Trek short films, and I got to direct myself as Harry Mudd in this 15-minute Star Trek short film, and a lot of visual effects and special effects and motion capture and stuff like that. It was really, really, really fun.
Was that recent?
Yeah, that was about 2 years ago. Yeah, so this is called Star Trek Discovery. If you go to where the Star Treks are. Here it's on CBS All Access, you know, wherever they happen to live, and then Paramount Plus or whatever. And then they have Star Trek shorts and it's back there. So something I'm proud of.
Have you been on any sets in the past sort of year and a half since the pandemic, or have you?
Yeah.
How's it been? How did that affect the industry there?
Yeah, it was, it was definitely strange, you know. I do a recurring part in this show called Mom, this comedy in America, and a couple other things. And it's, you know, you're just getting swabbed in your nose every few hours, and you wear masks everywhere, and everyone keeps their distance. And it's kind of a comedy killer, you know, honestly. But it's not kind of warm and human and fun, but. You know, we get by. The show must go on. People need to have their jobs and people need their entertainment. So, but I think hopefully things will be changing pretty soon.
I wanted to ask you a question about Soul Pancake and in terms of the origins of it, and also, you know, what was the inspiration around creating something that was just about, you know, creating inspiring, fun, engaging, positive stories, platforms, and actions, which, you know, it sounds so simple when you say it like that, but actually there's a paucity of those kind of places to do that, just to sort of celebrate and to be, you know, full of just sort of sheer joy. How did it all come about?
I love your use of the word paucity in that question.
Do you know, I was just going to say
thank you very much.
Yeah. Just going to add that to the list. All right.
So thanks for asking. You know, when The Office started, I got together with some friends. I was like, looks like I've got a job that's going to last for a while. I'm going to make a little money. And I was like, I just want to do something really positive on the web. What do we do? You know, so we started this soulpancake.com as a website, as a web destination, kind of hub for people to gather and talk about life's big questions and share art. And there were challenges and articles. And it was almost like a part social media, part like online magazine. And that went fine. And we got some attention and we were on Oprah show about it and some other, you know, it was doing pretty well. But we realized that what we were best at was making video content. So Soul Pancake turned into a digital video content creating enterprise. And we wanted to make uplifting, inspiring content that brought people together. And we made a lot of kind of hit viral little digital shows that were on our YouTube channel or Facebook or what have you. And so it's been amazing. You know, we wrote a best-selling book and, you know, we've had 1 billion video views. And
no way.
Jesus, that's incredible.
Christ. Yeah, yeah. And it's it was great. Like, I don't know if we made a difference, but, you know, maybe we cheered people up at some point in time. And maybe we brought a little bit of healing here, a little understanding there, a little warmth here or there. And I think that's what we all need to try and do. I think that's our human prerogative is to, people always used to say, and maybe some people still say like, well, don't hurt anyone else, live a good life. And that's all it needs. But I really feel like maybe that was true in the 80s or 90s, or I don't know. I don't think it really was because there's all kinds of injustice everywhere, but it doesn't work. That philosophy no longer carries any water. Just live a good life and don't hurt anyone else. Don't fuck anyone else up. Live a good life and take care of you and yours and don't hurt anyone else and make the world a better place and contribute in some way, shape, or form to some mode or measure of positivity in the world. And that can be, it can be small, man. It can be just like on your block, you have a bake sale for charity and, you know, whatever it is, it's like you wash your neighbor's car. It can be super small.
Helping the granny across the road, you know, just doing the good,
Exactly. But
saving
everyone,
the iguana.
Kids. Yep. Helping the iguana rescue, you know, traumatized iguana rescue is so important. There's literally in the LA area, I know of dozens of iguanas that have been sexually traumatized in really grotesque ways.
Oh no.
And they need to be brought back. You know, they need to be given good homes, safe, appropriate homes. So,
well, let's move on to back to Soul Pancake. But with it, there's a big focus on life's big questions. Have you got any answers to these, or do you just try and love the questions themselves?
Well, well asked. And I'm just launching, actually, in mid-June, a new podcast called Metaphysical Milkshake that I do with the writer Reza Aslan. And it is all about life's big questions, because that was one of the kind of the pillars that we created Soul Pancake. What is a way of uniting us all? Well, life's biggest questions, whether you're a Democrat or Republican or you know, a Tory or a Labour or whatever, Scottish independence or, you know, the big questions, why are we here? Do we have free will? What is love? You know, these big questions are what are human questions that we've been asking since the dawn of time. So this was an important part of Soul Pancake. And I will say that What are my big questions? Yeah, I don't know that I have many answers, but I love the asking of the questions, the probing of the questions. I was really like the probing of the iguanas. I was a kid. I would literally be at like a high school party and go up to someone and say, "Hey, do you believe in God?" You know, not because I was trying to convert them or anything. I was just really interested. Like, what do you think happens when we die? Like, and people are just like, look weird. And they, you know, people are
stay away from that rain, boy.
Yeah. They so freaked out by it. But this, I was just that. I've just always been that person. I've always asked the inappropriately large questions.
Well, I got to say, Rain, your interview in the back of the van with Elon Musk was particularly fun when you asked him the question, "What's life like being named after a smell?" I thought that was particularly insightful and also ego pricking. I can't remember what his response was, but it was quite short lived. But you did seem to sort of relish that interviewee role, which must naturally sort of come about having being, you know, predominantly in your life and career on the other side of the question. So it must be really nice to be able to sort of wield that knife.
Yeah, I love doing interviews. I love doing podcasts and talking, especially when you get to be both absurd and profound, as we've been doing a little bit on this podcast. So I like sexually traumatized iguana jokes hand in hand with the meaning of life conversations. And so, yeah, that was a treat. There's way more footage of me with Elon Musk. And I've been telling him, like, he's like the richest guy in the world now. You got to find all that footage and put together a new fun, you know, interview with him. So,
Well, not necessarily this week because his comedy performance on SNL has tanked cryptocurrency, isn't it?
Yeah, Dogecoin is not.
Get Salt Pancake away from it. You're like, oh no, we've never interviewed that smell.
another thing that Rain and I share, which I don't believe any of the other people in this podcast do.
Tapeworms.
Is other than tapeworms, allegedly, is that Rain and I have both stood on a glacier before. I saw via Salt Pancake your visit to Greenland. I lived in New Zealand for a while and I hiked up a glacier a few years back. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in terms of your desire to sort of showcase what is happening kind of with climate change, I enjoyed the fact that the video, you know, you're presenting things in a fun and easygoing way, but this is obviously like a really sort of crucial topic. What are your primary endeavors of, you know, trying to convey this message? Are you really asking for people to make significant changes or just to be just purely aware that change is afoot?
Well, to quote Frightened Rabbit, while I'm alive, I make tiny changes to Earth. And this is truly one of my favorite and most profound lyrics. And I always felt like I need to, like, as they say, like, shit or get off the pot. Like, I got to do something about climate change, especially in my position as a celebrity, other than send out occasional angry tweets. You know, that's not enough. And drive an electric car and angrily tweet occasionally, that's not going to cut it. So I was like, that led me to joining the board of this nonprofit called Arctic Base Camp, doing a trip with them up to Greenland, documenting it, making a little documentary series that I hopefully is fun and uplifting and goofy enough to have a younger audience so they kind of learn about climate change in some new and interesting ways. And I still do more work with this nonprofit. And, you know, you've got to put your money where your mouth is. And it doesn't have to be money. It can be time. You know, we all make tiny changes to Earth and in whatever way we can. You don't need to be a celebrity to be involved in the, you know, philanthropy or, you know, kind of public awareness or whatever. Everyone can make a difference, and it can be very small, you know. That was a profound pleasure. And being in Greenland was an extraordinary experience. Extraordinary.
I'm actually, this is not joking, I'm a geography graduate, and I did a considerable amount of work about past climate change as part of my degree. So maybe on another occasion, another podcast, you and I can get together and talk about the nature of thermohaline circulation and how the melting of the glaciers in the Northern Hemisphere are contributing towards the lack of formation of North Atlantic deep water. And actually, we're all going to freeze eventually. But we'll save that for another time, possibly. Eventually. It's true. We will. Anyway, on to something slightly more positive, Rain. What are you looking forward to for, you know, the rest of this year? What's exciting you? What's on your radar? What are you looking forward to?
Well, I'm looking forward to the world being vaccinated and us finding a way out of this. I'm looking forward to whatever small lessons we learned from this pandemic to be applied more globally with humanity to let it bring us together and educate us and move things forward. I'm going to be filming a movie in this summer, which I'm excited about, and more Terry Carnation episodes coming. And I'm writing a book on spirituality. So,
busy.
As long as it comes out after October, because that's when Modern British Side is coming out. Just saying.
Yeah, because that's the crossover
put down my copy of Rain Wilson's new book. This Modern British Cider seems really good.
Can you get your book in the US anywhere?
The reason why Grant asked the question and Martin is laughing quite audibly is that my publisher informed me that the rate of sale of my book in the US was not commensurate with the cost of shipping. So there are many, I would say at least a couple of thousand copies sat in a warehouse in Oxfordshire.
Well, can we see if we can increase it?
Demand.
Can we increase it by just saying, have Rain say, please everyone buy Ciderology by Gabe Cook.
Please everyone buy Ciderology by Gabe Cook.
Perfect.
There we go. There's three sales there straight away. Fantastic.
I think you're overestimating my celebrity clout, you know. I'm very old hat, like, oh, that weird old guy, he's been on 1,000 shows, I don't give a fuck what he has to say. So
you maybe get two sales out of it then.
It's more than we've got, so I'll take it. Thank you very much. Yeah,
fair enough.
Deal. Rain, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure having a good old yak and chin mug with you. For anybody who's listening who wants to listen to Terry Carnation or to, you know, just learn more about all of your activities, what are the best sort of social media and web places for them to head to?
At Ciderology on Instagram.
Thank you very much. Actually, it's Ciderologist, but yeah, that's okay. Well, it's close enough.
I don't know. You can follow me on social media or not. I don't really care, but I love each and every one of you. And thanks for having me. This was really fun, and it was a great conversation. And it was a pleasure meeting you, gentlemen. And Grant, it was great seeing you again. And I hope you stay.
You too.
In touch.
Thank you so much, man. Really appreciate it.
Awesome. Cheers, Rain.
Okay, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And now here at the Neutral Cider Hotel, it's time to try some cider. And this week we are going for Hogan's Libertine Cider. Hogan's is a UK producer based up in Warwickshire, and they sit in the rank of larger of the small producers, making great ciders more widely available. And this particular one has just won multiple gold medals at competitions, so it seemed to be a good one to try. Shall we crack it open and have a go, chaps? Here we go.
Oh, nice color.
Now what's Grant's already nailed it. What's interesting about this cider is that it is a sweeter cider, and it's not a sweeter cider that's been achieved through a keeving methodology or like a like a multiple racking to retain a residual sweetness. So natural sugars from the apple juice not converted to apple into cider. This is not that. This is whereby it's fermented to dry and some sugar has been added back. But they've added sugar and also I think some like dark sugar, like a demerara or something like that. And it just adds this sort of spicy unctuousness, which in with the, you know, so it's tannic fruit. So it's low acid. It's all, well, you tell me, what do you think?
Lovely. Like proper. Yeah, just like, it's how do I explain it? You know, like it doesn't taste like apple pie, but it's all that kind of caramelized sugar vibe on top of it. It's just like real stewed apple fruit.
It's like a tart tatin, you know, like that.
Yeah.
Kind of burnt sugar.
They nailed it. That's definitely the food match for it, isn't it? Absolutely. Mm.
But the texture as well, like you've got that grippiness, that astringency, but it's kind of subdued with some of the like the sugar and body that mellows it out. But so my tongue is just covered, but there's a little finish that makes me want to neck more. So that is just, I mean, that's got to be by the pint, isn't it?
It's a bit of a ripper, I think. That's awesome. And it's part of the reason I like it is that there's a link back to something before. The sort of head cider maker for Alan, a guy called Sean, he was effectively the primary cider maker at Weston's for about 20 years or so. And I got to work alongside him and he was brilliant. And Weston's used to do this amazing cider for Sainsbury's as part of their sort of Taste the Difference range in a 660 mil bottle, and they did it with fermented with molasses and it created this kind of flavor profile. And so I think this is a bit of an homage to that great sugar. I thought that was one of the best ciders that you could kind of get full stop, because I think underneath the sort of the richness of the sweetness, it's not cloying, but there's also this slightly, I don't know, I'm not going to say necessarily like acetic, but there's definitely like a twang kind of going on. There's some spice, there's a little bit of zing, a bit of funk. It's very, very harmonious. It's a very clever drink. It's very well put together. Like I say, this one, I think it was 2019, it won like sort of sweet tannic category, a Glint Cap in the USA, at Cider World. It just frequently wins awards, and you don't just do that just by being a sweeter cider. It's the fact that it's all about this balance. I think it's wicked.
Yeah. Do you know what varieties are used in it at all? Because there's a bit of like a hint of that kind of red berry-ish fruit to it. It's almost like when you're putting together a mojito and you go, no, a daiquiri, and you're like, shall I make a strawberry daiquiri? Shall I? I'll just make a daiquiri in the one I've made a strawberry daiquiri in. It's lovely. Absolutely lovely.
I don't know the specific varieties. It will be a blend of predominantly bittersweet. There might be some bitter sharp in there. What we do know is that Hogan's have been one of the cider makers from the earliest stores have put their ingredients on the side. For years and years and years, for as a reminder for everyone listening in the UK, in the EU and still in the UK, there is no legal necessity for a cider maker to place their ingredients on the side of their bottle on pack. There's a dispensation for alcohol. The fact that Hogan's have done so for like a dozen years or so now is testament to their wish to be transparent and to showcase what they kind of do. And it says, you know, English cider, apple juice, water, sugar, carbon dioxide, a little bit of malic acid has been added there to maybe at the point of pressing the juice to provide a bit of protection for the cider as it's fermenting to sort of try and stave off some of the bad bacteria and such like. So pretty minimal of ingredients have been placed into it. But also, I just really appreciate that upfront honesty. And you know exactly what it is that you're purchasing.
How much water are we talking, do you think? You know,
well, what do you reckon? 6.2%. Yeah. I think it'd be no more than 20%, probably.
And is that literally to bring down ABV or like what? You know,
I would have thought so, to bring down ABV and it might be less. I really don't know. 6.2 is a fairly robust alcohol level in any kind of given year. The apples would be in and around that area. It would also be to mix in any kind of sugar or acid that you might be adding back to it. I suspect, given the way that that Alan is a very, very genial kind of guy. And if we asked, he would probably say what it was. Yeah. We'll try and find out for you.
Well, on the tasting of it, it doesn't feel like any of the characters diluted, which is either a great testament if he's put loads of water in, but if not, it's clearly for kind of the product as a packaged product, rather than just being like, oh, it's raw, it's natural, this is what it is. You're creating something for a market that wants something not necessarily repeatable, but they want to guarantee the quality every time. And I've drank a few of his now, and everyone I've been like surprised at how Moorish they are.
I know, which is why I was asking about the water, because quite often you can this a cider with water in it just has this thin character that you can sort of tell that things are just a little fainter, you know. This still packs a punch flavor wise, you know.
This is got all of the intensity of aroma, of flavor, of mouthfeel. It's just a really, really well made drink. And I say Hogan's is in that tranche of cider makers that I want them to grow, so that great cider like this, so this can get into a supermarket, or so that this can. Imagine this like in keg, like across a load of pubs, like people going, this is an amazing cider, this is an amazing drink, and I really want to enjoy this. And that's all about scalability. These are the cider makers that I think actually have a slightly different role to play compared to the little Pomona's of our world, but no less important.
If this is going to be someone's introduction on a keg or like a bottle in like a farm shop or something like that, there's not many better places to start for something which is commercially sound, but also not just bland and boring. There's so much going on here, but it's not a challenge. It's just, absolute knocked out of the park.
Accessible and complex.
What do we think about the label?
I like the label, to be honest. And I think it's one of those where it's kind of a playful take on a traditional kind of style, isn't it? Where it's just typography, and it's a lot of typography. There's a lot of different fonts.
A lot of fonts.
But I like that it looks a bit rugged, doesn't look fully polished. But that's just me.
I wonder what Cider George would have to say about it.
Well, there's a lot going on, my loves.
Too many words, though, isn't it?
I probably have
too many words.
Yeah.
Here.
Colors good.
The stickers.
Bittersweet. Libertine. I know exactly what that is.
Rich, decadent, bittersweet. Cider.
Right. He's Australian now. Rich, decadent, bittersweet.
All right, there we go. So it's a thumbs up all round, I would say, for Hogan's Libertine. And if you want to check it out for yourself, head to hogans.cider.co.uk. You can buy this and other fantastic ciders from their portfolio straight from their website. Give them a try. You won't be disappointed. Okay, that does it for our tasting this week. Next up, we've got your listeners' questions. So now here at the Neutral Cider Hotel, it's your burning questions answered by us. Martin, what have we got?
So yes, Gabe, this week it is actually a question that I think is asked with more intent for an answer than most weeks. So this week it is a previous guest of the show. Scott, play the clip.
Hi guys, it's Kath here. I'm sending you a message on behalf of Foxwellpians everywhere. I know that you have some lovely footage which has been cut from previous podcasts, and we would be so happy if you could hashtag release the Foxwhelp cut. Thank you so much. Hope to hear soon.
So they've got a hashtag.
We're not going to. So that wraps it up for this week.
Goodbye. No, we wouldn't do that. I mean, the love of the Foxwell holds no bounds with Kath Potter. Amazing. She will put a hashtag on it. Release the fox.
What was it? Crack pipe?
Yes.
She'll do a hashtags at us on the social.
Yeah. Hashtag release the fox 12 cut.
So is Kath assuming that there is some, sneaked away footage, or is this actual fact?
Well, this is fact, because we had an interview with her and Dick, and there were lots cut out of that. And then famously, we had Scott fade out one of our interviews because we ran out of time. Hey, it's producer Scott here. Don't like Foxwell.
Shame.
So yeah. There is the cutting room floor in this beautiful digital age is archived. So there's a lot of content that we've got that we know people like yourselves would actually enjoy listening to.
So what are we going to do about it?
I think what we're going to have to do is just lean into what we've got right now. And this is, I'm going to say, stage two of the Neutral Cider Hotel. We're going to have to get a little extension, a little...
Version 2.0.
Well, it's the same one. It's just got a more rooms, a couple more rooms, smaller rooms.
Building an outdoor space.
Yeah.
Like a garden room.
Garden.
Conservatory or something.
Yeah. Neutral Cider Garden.
It's a crappy conservatory. No, it's not. No, sorry, not crappy.
It's beautiful.
It's not crappy. It's beautiful. Oh god!
Shit.
But yeah, so we've got some stuff that we're pretty excited to show you guys, and I think I can speak for all of us in saying that this next year of the Neutral Cider Hotel is going to be fucking brilliant.
We've had some great guests so far, and I'm looking forward to the guests we're going to have on for the rest of the year. We're going to try and keep up the high standards. Looking at you, Kath and Dick.
Yes.
Looking at you. I'm excited about who we're going to have on over the next few months.
Exciting year ahead. So much more to come. And, you know, we're going to need you to join us for the journey. More of that to come later. But for now, that wraps things up for this episode. Thank you, everybody, for listening in. Obviously, a massive thank you to the wonderful Rainn Wilson for joining us and for having a good old chat with us. What a great conversation, one that we will never forget, I suspect. And if you enjoy our podcast and want to help, please spread the word about the Neutral Cider Hotel. Tell your friends about it, encourage them to listen. And you can also follow, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast app. It really, really, really does help. And please find and follow us on social media. We're at Neutral Cider Hotel on Instagram and Facebook, as well as Neutral Cider Pod on Twitter. As always, you can visit us on our website to listen online or share episodes at neutralciderhotel.com. And you can, as you've just heard from Kath, reach out to us and leave a voicemail with your questions or comments at speakpipe.com/Neutral Cider Hotel. I don't think you realize just how easy that is to do. Leave a message. We will listen to it. We will comment upon it. Please, please, please. So there we go. Another episode done. Gentlemen, I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.
Sure did.
Absolutely.
We'll see you next time. Cheers, everybody. What's up?
Rain, put that iguana down.